So as I said to you yesterday, the kind of format of the course essentially will be a very small amount of input, really, from me, and then essentially what I'm gauging is where that lands with each of you, and how you internalise that, to what extent you internalise it. We feed that back into the room, and that essentially gives me a sense of where to go next. So your feedback is crucial to that process, otherwise I'm just guessing, which is not good. It's not good. So we'll start at that point if we can, and just get a sense from you guys. Hi Sarah. It's all right, come on in. Just get a sense from where you are today. What did you notice yesterday, if anything? What did you take away? Anything that stayed with you? Anything that came up as a question? Anything that pops into your mind in the evening or this morning? Any connections that you may have made? Your own experience?
I just felt pretty calm and pretty relaxed and not very judgmental on anyone. As always,
with yeah, you felt chatting. Like you're in a kind of a clear space. That's nice. That's nice. Sorry?
Maybe it's because my wife and kids are into it.
They were aware of it.
So I couldn't set the quiet, but it was just, there wasn't much of that game.
But even before you got home,
you
noticed that. Yeah, this is a good sign.
I'm staying with my mother, who is a massive wind up, but doesn't mean to be.
Yeah.
And I did have to try and not be wound up, I just wasn't, which was really good.
And noticeable.
And it was so nice for her.
Of course. Yeah, yeah.
Instead of me being nitpicking and critical.
Yeah.
I mean, she said, oh, it was so lovely that you came to stay.
Ah.
She went along with it, actually.
Yeah.
And it would be all, oh, so you have to go and stuff. It wasn't any of that.
Is that nice?
Yeah.
These little things are, to me, they're not insignificant. These are the little things to look out for, because they are indicative of little shifts within you.
And I kind of wouldn't have said it apart from the fact that you said it, in the sense that I thought, oh well, maybe I was just tired and resistance
exactly.
is futile.
Exactly.
But, you know,
that's
like,
why I'm asking you, because I
yeah.
told you this. It's so easy to discount these things as being, oh well, you know, I was just in a good mood that day and it probably won't last, or you know, we just very quickly discount it as being insignificant.
Mm.
So that's why I want to just bring it into awareness and acknowledge it and say, well, actually, that's the byproduct of being in a relatively calm place yourself.
Mm.
And the great thing is, as you said, is that you weren't trying to be.
Mm.
Right? So that's not what I don't want you to hear in that is, oh, so what I need to do is to calm myself down.
Mm.
You know, Ian's teaching us strategies to get into a calm place. Well, I'm not. I didn't give you any, if you'd noticed. It's a byproduct. It happens automatically because that's what we default towards.
Right.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
And strangely enough, that's one of the most difficult things for people to take on board, that it can be so easy. Especially anybody who's done a lot of practices of certain kinds. You know, if you've learned a lot of, I don't know, meditation practice or whatever it is, anger management, or there's a lot of things that people do to try and calm themselves down, reduce their stress levels and so on. And the idea at first that actually you could attain that same, in fact better, place of being with inside yourself without doing anything seems ludicrous initially if you're used to that mode. And yet it's not. It makes perfect sense when you understand how your mind works.
Mm.
So what else?
Yeah, I was worried I'm going to be too tired. That's my thing at the moment. And you know, it was quite a tortuous journey at the moment with all the work. So I just didn't worry about that. But what I found myself doing was trying to relate everything you said yesterday to my life and my circumstances. And
I warned you about that, didn't I?
Yeah.
It's tempting, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so.
So how did you get rid of that? Did you get tangled with it?
Yeah, a bit. Yeah, because you know, people relate their experiences and then obviously not your own.
Yeah.
And trying to think, oh, well, that's theirs. Now, how would that fit with me? And I need to try to stop doing that, really.
Yeah, you went into the analysis mode.
Yeah.
And again, it's just good to notice. That's just a tendency of the mind, which many of us have. Hi, Sharon. And you can see where it leads to.
Yeah. It's futile, really, because you can't predict a scenario, can you? Well, I don't think.
Not reliably,
really.
No.
You know, it's a story, so
yeah.
That's a waste of energy, which I notice more and more.
Yeah. Mm. And it's good to see, it's just good to catch that, to notice that we can expend a lot of energy anticipating how we think it's going to be, or someone's going to be, or how I'm going to be. And then we start worrying about it, and then we start thinking, well, what do I need to do in order to mitigate that?
Mm.
So we've created an imaginary problem, and then we're trying to find a solution for an imaginary problem, which of course is futile, because the problem doesn't exist, except in our own thinking, you know? So there's never going to be a solution that's really going to work for it. But it's amazing when you see that, when you actually see it in operation, you go, wow, how crazy is that?
But the thing is, I think, is when there is a problem, that's the bit I'm waiting to try and work through.
It's no difference. I'm going to let you in on a secret. What we think are real problems, what you'll start to see, they're in exactly the same category as the imaginary ones. It's just that we can't see that they are the products of our thinking at the time. And the moment you see that, what you thought was a problem stops being a problem.
Mm. Yeah. That happened a little bit last night with George.
Yeah.
My son had a bit of an accident, and I spoke to him on the phone, and he told me what had happened. And I could have, you know, started to imagine all kinds of thoughts coming in.
Yeah.
It was a lot worse than it was, but I was aware that was happening,
mm-hmm.
and then it subsided. And, you know.
And actually, it was just, he banged his head and he was okay.
He was okay. And I'd spoken to him, so he's fine.
Yeah.
So all that add on.
Yeah, the additional thought that could have created a big problem for you.
For me.
Didn't
for
happen.
Him, he's okay at hand.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the bit that you'll start to see more and more, is that there's an exact correspondence between, how can I put it simply, between the level to which you can see that something is coming out of your own thinking. The degree to which you can see that is the degree to which the external world won't bother you in ways that it used to bother you. That's all it is. That's the only, I mean, it seems like nothing. It seems like I'm talking about almost nothing. It's just a shift in perception in your relationship to the things that you're looking at. But what can seem like an insurmountable problem, or something that you've racked your brains trying to solve for months on end, when you shift inside and you see that all of that, whatever you're feeling about it, that upset, that anxiety, that need to fix it, to make it okay, when you see that all of that is self-generated, it's not coming from the thing out there, none of it. The moment you see that, the thing out there loses its grip on you. Whether it's a person doing something that you don't like, or whether it's a life situation or a circumstance that you think has needed to change in your eyes, you suddenly see, actually, it doesn't need to change at all, it's fine, it's okay. Or that other person, they're just doing what they're doing, why do I need to be upset by that? You just see that very clearly.
I had that on the phone this morning, stopping from the conference. Early morning, hello, good morning. And then I was found myself getting caught up a bit in the, why are you being so defensive? And then I saw the image of the bubbles, and it was surprisingly easy to just let it go.
To not go there, yeah.
Just not forget it.
Yeah.
Next, and it was
yeah.
much easier somehow.
Yeah. It's quick.
It was very quick.
Yeah.
I was surprised.
That's
I was
nice.
Surprised how
yeah.
easy it
puts
in.
Yeah, it's a good example.
Yeah.
And again, it's those little, it's like those trains of thought that we've thought many times.
Mm.
It's almost like that, you know, that track has been well trodden.
Mm.
So there's a tendency to go there,
yeah.
but you caught it as it started going there. And at that moment, you go, huh, I don't have to. You know, I can see where it's going, and I don't have to get on board. And that's it. It's like all the air's got out of it, isn't it,
mm.
at that moment. Save yourself a lot of trouble.
Mm.
And after a while, what tends to happen is those tracks which would lead us in the direction of an argument or getting upset or getting distressed, they just become less and less appealing to us. And that's just common sense, really. You know, who really wants to get into an argument? No, none of us, really. Who wants to feel upset and distressed? Nobody. When we see that we don't have to, we just don't go there. It's like our wisdom somehow kicks in and says, well, why would you? If you see that it's optional, who in their right mind would go there?
It's a balance to a degree, because, you know, I think about it less in a personal setting, more something like a work setting. If you fully let yourself, you know, get walked over, but not get into any conflicts.
Conflicts, yeah.
Sometimes you need a bit to sort of set your boundaries and things like that, and if you don't do that, and you run the risk of being walked over or taken advantage of or something like that, maybe there's just perceptions that you think. But you know, you've got to be able to set your boundaries as well. And sometimes, you know, with the other person who might not be quite as aware as you,
yeah.
you know, you need to be a bit firmer and have those issues.
You might need to be, yeah. I mean, for sure, there's certain ways of being that you'll find that just works in that particular
yeah.
setting, but often we add stuff to that which is not necessary. So, you know, a lot of people think that they have to be aggressive in order to make themselves heard or make themselves clear, and that's just something that's been learned. You know, they've learned that, maybe it was modelled to them, or they learned it through a past experience, and they actually haven't tried the alternative. You know, they could just be clear without the aggression. Similarly, a lot of people in a work environment think that they have to look busy, you know. It's like, if I don't look busy, people think I'm lazy, or, you know, I'm not very productive. And actually, people who are just very busy are often not that productive. There's a lot of inefficiency in that mode, and they could just get the job done without having to create that appearance. Do you know what I mean? It's additional. So I think it's valid what you're saying, but it's also true to you'll start to see that there's a lot that we add to our behaviours which is not actually helpful. A lot of people who work in fields of like social justice, for example, they believe that they have to be kind of angry in order to get stuff done, in order to make people wake up to bring about change. And again, they don't see that anger and that distress is actually, first of all, it's not good for them. But second, it's also off-putting for the people they're trying to convert. You know, you can see people backing off when it's like that, you know, conflicting energy again. Whereas someone who's very calm, very clear, actually has got a better chance of winning people over. And you'll see this in, for example, in a sales environment as well. I'm working with a company at the moment. I'm helping their staff to, first of all, to relate better to each other, and then helping them to see that what they think are the problems in their workplace are actually internal. And one of the things we've been working with is some of the people who do selling, and asking them, you know, what is it that makes selling difficult for you? What kind of things would you imagine? If you were in an environment where you were essentially required to sell, what do you think makes it difficult to sell to people? What would make it difficult?
Asking people for money, or asking them to, you know, and it's about your own values, about what you feel about money, and if you were selling the product in the right way, and, you know, it actually
yeah.
makes you look at your confidence in yourself and your
yeah.
ability, and I'm sure
yeah.
never having done it. But
yeah. Yeah, so things like that, things like actually, you know, putting a price on it, telling a person this is how much it's going to cost you. Some people find that difficult. Not everybody does. But if you actually get underneath that, you get under the bonnet of that, and say, well, what actually makes that difficult? You know, what's inherently difficult in saying to someone, this costs 30 quid. Would you like to buy some?
It's also about the person's selling believes that it's something worth buying,
right?
Or that they have a right to ask somebody. It's those kind of things.
Exactly.
It's not about
exactly. It's the additional thought that we put on it, That's what makes it difficult. Or if we've got, say I've got a big investment in making the sale, you know, if I look at my figures for this month and I'm real way below and I'm not going to hit my commission, I'm not going to get my bonus, suddenly I start putting extra pressure on myself. It's like, gee, I really need to get the sale today. And guess what that does to my performance? Down it goes. Because other people pick that up. You know, they smell the desperation and nobody wants to buy from a desperate seller. There's a peculiar thing, it's known in the car sales field. There's a saying that the best time to sell a car to customers is when you just sold them. And it's obvious when you think about it. Why? Because there's no pressure now on the salesperson. The thing is, there wasn't any before. It was self-created. It's just that you don't see that when you're in the situation. You think that pressure is external. So we're going to talk about this a bit more later today. We're going to talk about stress, what we perceive as stress, and so on. We'll come around to that. Because it's a topic that's very, I think, prevalent. Everybody's got some ideas around that. But before we get there, let's just check in again. Anything else?
I had a night's sleep.
You had a night's sleep?
I was feeling very off balance. Literally, I was sort of staggering down the road yesterday with this thing, what's happening. Never had it before. And I started thinking, hang on a minute. So I was really aware of having to, you know, get here safely.
You were feeling unbalanced?
Yeah, totally. I still feel it a bit today, but I had some proper food. I was in my bed about 9:15. You put your earplugs in, hot water bottle. And that was it till about 12. Then I went through to 8. Which is the best thing.
A good night's sleep.
I was in the Caribbean somewhere. This has happened before. Like,
it's coming back to me now. You said that, I think,
in
the workshop.
Thing. The images are clicking in, but I don't know what the end of that, I don't care. It was very interesting.
That's
nice. I woke up just before the alarm. I thought, oh, how am I feeling? Oh, I think I'll make up my mind to be okay. You know, I think I'm okay.
Which is
the first thought, which is great.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That's very nice. It's a good start to the day. Yeah, sleep's another area which is there's a big correlation between this, what we're talking about, and sleep. Mm. When people say, well, okay, I understand that, Ian, but what do I do with it? You know, how do I do it? How do I apply it? It's a bit like, well, how do you get to sleep? You know, what do you have to do to get to sleep? And what you'll notice the only people who have to do anything to get to sleep are insomniacs, right? And they usually have a list of rituals and things that I can't get to sleep unless I've done this and I've done this. And everybody else just goes to sleep, right? It's not anything we have to do. It's a completely natural thing. We lie down, when we're tired, we close our eyes and we fall asleep. And this is exactly the same. It's like, well, how do I, you know, get to this place where my mind is just relatively quiet and I'm not burdened with extra thought? Well, you don't have to do anything. That's your natural state. It's like falling asleep. It's the same. So one of the side effects of this, people often report, is improvement in sleep if there's a difficulty getting to sleep. But some people also find the need to sleep more for a period when they get into this. And I think that probably just relates to the fact that we've been overdosing on thought for a long time. And it's tiring.
I actually find I'm very unsettled in myself.
Yeah. And did you just let that be okay, or did you add anything to it?
No, just letting it sink in.
Letting it sink in, yeah. Yeah.
understand why it unsettled me. I knew that something was happening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it can be unsettling at first, just to take that on board. It can be. Although, I would say more people, rather than being unsettled by it, more people actually find that it's a relief. It's a relief to realise that we're not the victim of all these things that we thought we were. We're only the victim of one thing. It's our own thinking. It's just one thing. It's a lot less to deal with than all these other things that we thought we were up against. So most people, when they see that, it brings a sense of relief. Not for everyone. What else? Anything else?
I do kind of think that if I don't engage,
yeah,
am I just going to turn into some sort of happy zombie? You know, it's like...
If you don't engage with what?
With people or conflict or whatever. But that's just my butts coming in, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's something that often gets asked in different ways. When the person says, if I don't do what I've always done, you know, if
I mean it that way, actually, I mean just, you know, it's not about being walked over, like Mark was saying, but I mean, if I don't push it's that thing of having to push to make things happen.
Right.
I suppose it's about
nothing will happen.
Just being
it seems
a neutral rather than being a push pull, or it's okay. You know,
it will be. I can assure you. And in fact, what people are often surprised to find is that rather than getting less productive, they actually get more so, because there's less noise in the system. They waste their resources and energies less, so there's more available for the things that you're actually interested in, passionate about. I found that there was actually extra horsepower available. So rather than getting lazy, as it were, and what I found was that there were more things that I could see I could get on with now, because I had the energy available to do it. So it's a common concern that people have. It's like, am I just going to be vegged out and, you know, not actually have the
desire
to do anything. Yeah, a lot of people have asked that. I've never seen it happen. But you might have a period of slowing down. People who've been over busy, you know, if you've been very chronically over busy, there might be a period where you just slow down for a while, because that's kind of a period of rest that's needed. Anything else that's been noticed?
I
Jane?
Went back to my learning journal.
When you were the homeopathy course?
Yeah. I haven't read that for, obviously, since I wrote it, or went through it at the end, just about 3 years. And I had a page in which I said it was words of wisdom. And there was one particular little thing that stuck out, which was be afraid of nothing you have within you, or I can't remember how exactly it went, power, strength, wisdom, knowledge. And thought, well, but I am quite a fearful person.
Uh-huh.
But fear is just thought, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
So there's nothing really to be afraid of.
Uh-huh. Right.
I'm just sitting here thinking, I actually did do something this morning which I probably would have been very afraid of doing, and I sent an email asking for quite a lot of money. But I just thought, well, you know, I'm going to ask, and it's up to them, isn't it?
Exactly.
I'm not afraid of asking. So I did that.
That's nice. Again, these little things are indicative. It's very free. Of course.
Because that's just your head telling you that might not work, or.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. And then you tone down, you know, your aspirations, things that you actually want to do. You talk yourself out of doing it for no good reason, really.
Yeah. And not be afraid of the outcome, I think, as well.
Exactly.
You know, doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter,
But then there's this certain level of, you know, I don't know if it's indifference. To some extent,
The kind of neutrality that comes, I would call it that, rather than indifference. A sort of neutrality, in the sense that you're not so attached, let's say. Like you when, the way you describe that, you're not so attached to the outcome.
No.
Therefore, you don't have to be afraid of it. You know? It's like, well, I'll either say yes or no. And if they say no, I can ask someone else, or I can ask again, or I can look somewhere else. You know what I mean? It's not loaded with extra meaning. Well, it might swing the odds a little bit in your favour because you're not asking from a needy place.
No, which is what I would have done, particularly with this person, but I have noticed I've been a bit less like that with him.
Yeah.
So I need to have a bit of a relationship because I've got obviously three children and sometimes things come up. And I've noticed quite a difference in if I'm much more calm and not on the attack or the defensive.
Yeah, you get a different response.
I just say how it is.
Yeah.
This is how it is. Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
It's a very different response.
Of course.
Yeah. Which is so much more positive.
Exactly. For everybody.
For everybody.
Yeah, it's a win-win.
Also, if you don't have that fear, it doesn't have that terrible effect on your physical body. I mean, I don't know. I know if I'm feeling fearful, I'm tense.
Yeah, it takes a toll on your well-being.
You do that for years. And
exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bad for the kidneys, according to Chinese medicine. To be in a state of continuous anxiety or fear or worry, it's very depleting for the body. And similarly with all the other emotions that we can habitually fall prey to. Yeah. As I said yesterday, it seems like our bodies weren't designed to run on that kind of fuel. You know, those... It seems like the design is that those will be occasional things that we feel, which pass very quickly. It's not something we should be feeling all the time, like flooding our system with adrenaline. It's completely foreign to us. So that's a good thing to notice. Yeah, I don't have to be afraid. And if I am, I know that it's a product of my own thinking. It's not coming from where I thought it was coming from. That's powerful. Well, I'm getting that, and it's powerful to see that, just to see the nature of it. It's like, oh, okay. And when you said, I'm quite a fearful person, you might start to see that that maybe is a case of mistaken identity. Do you get what I'm saying there?
No, not really.
Well, remember the story I told you about Sydney Banks' experience? What did he describe himself as?
Insecure.
As an insecure person. And one person said to him was, Sydney, it's not that you are insecure, it's just that you have a lot of insecure thoughts.
Mm. Yeah.
And as soon as he got that that was true, he was no longer an insecure person. And in that sense, there's no such thing as a fearful person. There's a person that's adopted a lot of fearful thinking, but that thinking could very quickly fall away. And then there's no longer a fearful person. That's all it takes. And similarly with an angry person or a depressive person, you know, there's no such thing actually. It's been acquired. Nobody's born that way. You don't see babies born depressive, or you don't, and they're not born angry or upset or fearful unless there's something that's actually impinging on them. That has to be acquired, it has to be learned, it has to be conditioned in, and then they have to maintain it into adulthood. And that's helpful to start to see that anything that's been learned can be let go much quicker than we imagine.
I was just going to say, well, actually that's not true, because I've had three children, and I was obviously very fearful when I had my first child.
That's
how
he reflected that back to you.
When I had my third child, I very strongly remember thinking, I've done this, and I didn't think there's nothing to be afraid of, but what, I can do this.
Yeah.
And he wasn't an easy baby, but it didn't bother me.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was just so much nicer.
That's it. Anything else? Sharon, anything you've
Well, I didn't sleep very well at all. It was really quite unusual.
You had a busy night.
I normally do. And I couldn't really, I think it was more excitement.
You were buzzing.
Yeah, because I wasn't, you know, there wasn't particular thought processes going on. I just asked myself, okay, so what, you know, what's keeping you up? Is this really quite bizarre? And I think it was just sort of like, wow, yes.
You were getting a taste of something.
Yeah, and the possibilities. I was going down that road and looking back, and it was just, you know, I got to about four, because I woke up at 1:30, same time. I've gone to sleep and woke up at 1:30, and I think it's about 4:00, and I thought, I really need to go to sleep again now. And I think I dozed off about 6:00, and my daughter rang me at 6:30, so sort of not quite sure what I'm feeling at the moment. But it wasn't, it was that knowing, I sort of spoke about yesterday, it's that it was actually put into words what I've been feeling for probably most of this year, sort of working towards it all, and it was just thinking, yes,
yeah,
this is where I'm supposed to be at this minute.
Yeah. What do you know? What were the possibilities that you started to see?
Well, they were just, they're popping into my head all over the place. I actually started to feel like I was going to get a migraine. I've suffered from migraines for most of my life. And yesterday I was actually, it started about 4:30, and I was actually sitting there thinking, no, you're not going to do this. I didn't, you know, it went away, but the pain really started to kick in. And I was just saying, right, okay, this is just your thinking.
What would you normally have done when that pain starts to kick in? What would you normally have done in your own thought process, do you think?
Actually, I don't know.
It's hard to remember, isn't it?
Yes.
Even though you've done it a million times.
Yeah, it would be a sort of, okay, what can I do about this, because it's going to get worse.
Right, exactly.
You know, it's that normally I'm either violently sick or I have to just go to bed and wait for it to go
away. So you'd start thinking about how bad it's going to get and what you need to do to mitigate that and so on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that in itself is quite a realisation that actually that's just all in my head.
It is.
Literally.
Yeah. It's one of the other things that I want to talk about a bit more today, which you just reminded me of, is what I call additional thought. I'll touch on this in a few different ways. Additional thought is basically all that extra thinking that we add to something, which is not helpful. And that would be an area where you would see that very clearly. That, you know, as soon as you start to get that pain, your mind gets busy and you have all this additional thought about it, what that means, where it's leading, it's going to ruin your day, it's going to end up like this, you're going to have to do that and that and that. And the effect of that additional thought is probably at least as bad, and sometimes it's worse than the thing itself. And we don't see that. We don't see the consequence of it. Sometimes the additional thought is the only thing that makes the life experience difficult. So this is something that you'll start to see more and more, is that there is a habitual tendency sometimes just to add a lot of extra thought to something, rather than just to let it be as it is.
Last night, and I might talk about it a bit later on, but living in a stressful environment.
Yeah.
Oh. Having a lot
of what's a stressful environment?
I'm having extreme problems with my downstairs neighbours, very unwell.
Mm.
It's been going on a long time. Police are involved, council, and I might have to move. I might stay. I don't know what's happening.
So is that a stressful environment?
It has been. I feel very unsure of, well, who knows what's going to happen anyway. But I caught myself last night. I do want to talk about this for about 3 hours, by the way. I'm just pracing it down to,
okay.
I caught myself when I went in last night, I went, is okay at the moment. And it's going, yeah, but what, you know, you might have to, and it's here, and oh, and he's da da da. And I'm thinking, not at the moment, thank you very much. Food.
So in that moment,
yes.
when you plucked in like that, and you just shifted your priority to, okay, what I need to do is to eat, but to rest. In that moment, were you in a stressful environment?
In my head, yes, but...
Really?
Well, I felt the fear,
mm-hmm.
and I...
And then in the moment, subsequently, when you said to yourself, okay, just eat, and
yep,
don't worry about...
Okay.
Were you in a stressful environment
no.
then? No.
And that's what I caught myself, right? So
that's
all
it.
This other stuff is... add on
additional thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the only thing that makes an environment stressful.
Yes.
There is no such thing as a stressful environment if you take away the additional thinking about it.
Yeah, but I'm special and different. I was going to do the lottery yesterday and my problems would have gone out the window.
Oh.
So I didn't do it. You know, it's all this what's the reality? I don't know.
It's what you're in the moment. That's the only reality each of us has. And you see how quick it can change.
Yeah. Yeah, and I picture all the police involved and PC Fox and, you know, he's doing his investigation about this guy. And he,
but
it's a bloody Mike Lee play.
Yeah. Yeah, anybody running that kind of thinking would experience life as being stressful. Irrespective of the actual circumstances that you're living in.
Yeah.
That's the connection.
It's like a sort of...
It's starting to see.
You know, dragging this crap around.
Yeah.
And, it's okay.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is okay. It is. And I'm not saying that, you know, sometimes we might be in a life situation where there might be some things that need to change in order for it to be a healthier environment for you to live in. There's no denying that. You know, if you're living in a damp basement and you're getting sick because it's, you know, it's not actually a healthy environment, it might be a good idea to get a plumber or to get it sorted or move, you know, if that's the only option that seems viable. What I'm saying is that everything we add to that makes it seem much bigger than it is, and it generates the majority of the suffering that we experience, the distress that we experience, is not generated by the situation. It's our internal thoughts about it, stressful thoughts about it. And the interesting thing is when you see that and they start to clear, like when the clouds start to clear in your own head, if something needs sorting out, you're in a much better position to do it now. So it's not like Jude was worrying, it doesn't diminish your ability to be effective and to take action. On the contrary, you just get very clear, you say, okay, actually what I need to do, I need to do X, Y, and Z. From that clear place, you actually become a lot more liable to be proactive to get things done. So it is helpful in terms of that as well, if things need to be fixed. But the difference is that you're not trying to change the outside world in order to feel better within yourself. You recognize that your own feeling state is self-generated. Recognizing that puts you in a better feeling state already. Once you're in a better feeling state, you're in a really good place to take some positive steps that need taken. Does everybody see the difference there? Most of us put the cart before the horse. What we try and do is manipulate the environment in order to feel better. So when that's sorted out, when that's sorted out, when my husband stops doing this, when my partner stops doing that, when I got the job sorted and income sorted, and when I've won the lottery, then I can relax. You know, all of that has to change first before I can feel okay. That's the cart before the horse. And of course it's endless. There's no end to the number of things that we have to fix and sort and change before we get to the okay place. It becomes like an elusive holy grail that we never quite reach. The moment you see that you could be okay in this moment, today, even living in this situation that you're living in, you could be okay right now. And the moment you get that, from that place of okayness, you look out at the same situation, suddenly you know what needs doing. And you know that actually that's not a big deal, I just thought it was. But this still needs sorting. You know, it's like, it becomes very clear to you.
It's also about, I hear from that it's about me taking responsibility for myself as well, instead of expecting other people or other things to fix it for me.
Yes.
The person who can do this is me, and I know that's very, very obvious.
Yeah, except that there are times when we need help also.
I know, but it's like...
Which is fine. Knowing the difference, you know, it's knowing the difference that this is mine, this is, I need to take care of this, but there are sometimes say, actually, that's beyond my knowledge, it's beyond my expertise, it's beyond the limits of what I can do.
But
I need to get
some
help.
You know, everything will be fine when I win the lottery or whatever it is. That's not, it's not realistic, in a sense.
No.
It's about, and if you always live in the unrealistic place,
yes.
Whatever your aims are,
it's
then
not.
It's not taking the responsibility is what I mean.
That's it. Yeah. Essentially, what we don't take responsibility for is what is the source, the origin of our own feelings. That, to me, that's the single place where we don't take responsibility, where it would help us if we did.
Do we need to know what it is, what the origin is? Do we need to find that out? Or does it
but only in very simple terms. It's enough to know that it's coming from your own thinking. You don't need to know what thoughts exactly. As I said yesterday, you don't have to get into the content. You just have to understand the nature of it. The nature of it is that your feelings are generated by your own thinking, not from anywhere else.
Because you're added to it once you start thinking which thought.
Exactly. Exactly. You'll get lost in the thought bubbles if you go that route. So that's not going to be helpful. But if you understand the nature of it, that's enough. It's quite enough. Fortunately, isn't
all the therapies that take you down to find out what the source is, then it's really wasted energy in a way.
It is. It is. Once you understand this, you see that that's not necessary. Until you understand this, it looked like a good idea. And that's the difference.
Not always feel like a good one.
Sorry?
But not always feel like a good one.
Well, it may or may not, depending on what kind of material you're accessing. So you can spend a lot of time going over experiences which are actually quite painful and quite difficult, thinking that that's a good idea, but your experience of it is horrible. In which case, how can it be?
It's very interesting because whenever I'm going to see you for a consultation, I realize I'm always a bit scared.
Yeah.
And I think I'm always a bit scared also because, I feel the same way I did the very first time I walked, because I came in, I didn't know what to do. But walking, during that whatever experience it was, whatever fear was there, I always feel that same thing hitting in again. Whenever, and now I'm realizing that's just the thought of thinking that I know what's going to happen.
Exactly, again. Anticipatory thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you start getting anxious ahead of time. Yeah, that's all it is.
And it can start days.
Of course, yeah. And I think we all have some area of life where we would do that. You know, some people do it getting on a plane. Some people would do it going to see the therapist. Some people would do it asking for money. You know, it's like, why wait until you're actually doing the task? Why not get anxious a few days ahead? It doesn't make any sense, but that's what we do. And that's why I could unequivocally state that no one is afraid of what they say they're afraid of. Ever. And I would challenge you to see that for yourself. That you're never afraid of what you say you're afraid of. What's frightening you is only your thoughts about what you say you're afraid of. It's the only thing that can scare you.
That's very true. I see it.
You
see
it, huh?
When I don't have help. I always feel very anxious about not having help around with my kids because it does get mad. It does get crazy. But I'm far more anxious thinking about it and anticipating, you know.
Exactly.
You know, the nursery program or the nanny might come forward about my husband's not going to be all of these things. When it actually happens,
it's okay.
It's completely okay.
Exactly.
And they realize that, you know, I can actually do this again. It's time. It's a bit messy.
Yeah.
But it's completely okay.
Yeah.
And I think I see it very much with how my husband deals with them versus how I deal with it. I
yes.
always have this whole, you know, preparations and this, and we need to be prepared. And he's just completely, he's far more relaxed about it, and it allows him to take them out on his own. And he's fine.
Yeah.
He comes back and he's in good mood.
Yeah.
Because
he didn't add all that to it.
We have completely different approaches, and his always seems a lot more fun.
Mm-hmm. This is good to notice.
Why can't I be like that? Why can't I
right.
be there? And now I'm starting to probably realize what it is.
That's
know,
the only difference, yeah.
Yeah, it makes complete sense.
Yeah. This is common sense. When you start to see this, you think, oh yeah, it's obvious. Of course. Has anyone got a phobia here? Anyone phobic?
Rats? Yeah.
Yeah.
There are rats in the car.
Did you notice what you just did when you said the word? Now, I could have been mistaken, but I didn't see a rat run across when you said that word. For some reason, you got afraid. But isn't that interesting? Is that you don't need a rat in the room to have the fear of rats. So that proves what I just said, doesn't it? You can't be afraid of what you think you're afraid of, because there isn't one here.
I'm not going to lose that fear.
No, I'm not. I would encourage you to hold on to it. But any of these things that we say we're afraid of, how can it be that that's the thing we're afraid of? How can we be feeling the fear when it's not even visible to us in the moment? Sorry? It's just the thought. That's the only thing that's frightening us. It's the only thing that can frighten us, is our own thinking. Go on. What have you pressed pause?
If there was a rat in the room, then.
Yes.
Then you'd have the right to be, well, then
yeah.
you're not
that's
afraid.
That's what I want to say. Is
you're not afraid
I've
now.
I've got a right to be afraid.
Absolutely. You've got every right to be afraid. However, it's optional. It's not required. It's optional.
Yeah.
My daughter's a school friend who loves rats. She loves them. She has them as pets. She loves them. She's really fascinated by them. She thinks they're the most intelligent creatures. She offers to bring them round to our house. So for her, a rat running in the room would be the highlight of her day. It's like, why is a rat, you know? She'd love it. So there's no requirement to be afraid of rats. You following?
I just thought also with fears is... It's just trying to starting to ride a motorcycle around good small times. But so because I was a bit worried about it. And I think when I did have a little small accident where I got into a dream. That's okay. But when it did happen, it wasn't that bad.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow I managed to get off of it very quickly. I mean it wasn't in the actual moment
mm-hmm.
of it, it wasn't that panicky.
Just something that happened, and you were
the
okay.
Thoughts about it later.
Exactly.
Is what made me panic. It wasn't.
Exactly.
It wasn't what happened. But
that's
it was
it.
Okay. It's
you got it.
Else. It's
that's
just
it.
Later on. I.
Yeah.
Now I'm gonna get on a motorcycle again. I did get back on it, drive it.
Yes.
I did down the road, up the road.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. But I'm.
But you see, we're not scared of what we think.
It's
we're scared.
The actual
of.
Thing.
We're not. I like to give the example of, supposing you were walking across a minefield, you know, where there's like unexploded mines underground, except you didn't know it was a minefield. It looked to you like it was just an empty field with pretty flowers. So as you're walking across and your life is in peril, would you be scared?
Yeah.
Of course not. But if you got to the other side and then you saw a sign with big red letters, danger, unexploded mines, what would happen? You start shaking and freaking out, even though you're safe now, right? Now you'd be afraid of dying, or the fact that you could have died, or the thought that you might die. It's your thoughts that's freaking you out.
And your awareness, because you're able to see it. If there was a rat crawling up your leg and you didn't know that it was there.
Exactly.
You wouldn't be scared.
You're right.
But
yeah,
if you did know,
exactly,
as
soon
as you know, someone brings it to your attention, you're going to be...
Yes.
But if you didn't know about it, you couldn't...
Exactly.
You couldn't discover it.
If it's not in your thinking,
yeah,
you won't have
it's
the...
It's not in your reality.
It's not in your experience. When I started talking about this stuff, I was with a group in Croatia, and there was a guy in the group, and we were talking about this connection between, if it's not in your thinking, it's not in your experience, it doesn't exist for you. And he suddenly had like a little light bulb moment. He said, oh God, I just remembered something. When he was about 17, he was in a bar, and there was this girl who he was trying to chat up, who he really liked, you know, he was hoping he was going to get a date with this girl. So he was really sort of, you know, turning on the charm and maintaining eye contact with her and, you know, hanging on her every word. And meanwhile, he's got his hand in his jacket pocket, and every now and again he'd notice that it was kind of wet. And but he dismissed it because he, you know, he didn't want to lose the connection with this lovely girl. So he'd go, oh, yeah, it's wet. And anyway, he'd go back to talking to her and so on. And at some point he excused himself and went to the bathroom. And he goes to the bathroom, he pulls his hand out, it's dripping blood. And it turned out he had a razor in his pocket. He'd been staying over at a friend's house. He'd actually been slashing his fingers open with a cutthroat razor. Felt no pain. No pain whatsoever. Just this occasional sensation of moisture. He was dripping blood. The moment he saw it, he said he almost passed out. And then suddenly the pain kicked in. There's thousands of examples like that. And we haven't seen the significance of this before. There's many cases where people are in an accident scenario, for example, and you know, they're badly injured. You would think they'd be in terrible suffering, etc. But in that moment, if they hear a baby cry, say, in the car, and they manage to drag themselves off to help somebody else, their thinking is somewhere else. And the moment they've done that and it's finished, that's when they suddenly realise, geez, I've got a broken leg. Or, you know, something that should be absolutely killing them. They didn't even notice it. Literally didn't notice it.
So you're saying in such a situation,
yeah,
I think it's more what's a priority with
it. It's where you put your thinking.
Yeah.
It's wherever your thinking goes.
So what you're focusing on,
yes,
in a way, everything else lacks.
Exactly.
Out.
And that's true of all of us, all of the time.
Yeah.
That's what we don't realise. All of the time we're looking through a certain lens and everything else is blacked out. There's all these other possibilities which are also existing for us. We just can't see them. They're not visible to us in that moment. And then as soon as our perception widens a little bit, oh yeah, huh, how could I have missed that? It suddenly is blindingly obvious.
But it's the immense power of it as well.
I know, it's huge. When you start to see the implications of that, it's huge. Such a little thing. Yeah. I know. And it's so easy to miss because it seems like something relatively small and insignificant. But it's only when you experience it that you start to see the power of it. That's why it's an experiential learning rather than a kind of informational learning. You know. So Jan wasn't with us yesterday. So what are you picking up from all this, Jan?
I wasn't here yesterday.
I know. I want to check in with you and see what your sense is of what we've been talking about.
Mixed.
Yeah. What have you heard in what's been discussed?
I've heard that you're working with people's reality as a perception of themselves and the perception of what they see, and that's a very narrow view for all of us.
Yeah.
So if we can widen that and open to possibilities, then we don't have to have our emotional states linked to directly what's happening in the external environment. But there is also some resistance in me, that I feel this is kind of very privileged thinking, and I necessarily lived or worked in environments where people's now, what they're experiencing isn't horrific, because it can be. So there's a sense of, I absolutely accept the additional thought, how difficult we can make things for ourselves, me included, and I welcome that. I think that's wonderful to start being able to maybe get myself out of that. But I also think it kind of misses that. I think we come in with stuff, and I think that things happen to people, certainly maybe not so much in this country, but I certainly witness things that are horrific. And I can't quite put the responsibility of someone's thought processes totally down to how they feel. There are realities of what happens to people. And there are also intuitions and things that need to be felt. So it's kind of, it feels slightly intellectual to me, like a slightly intellectual process to manage my thinking, to stop myself thinking, to stop myself.
Okay.
That's who I am. So that's
no, that's good.
School,
no, that's what I needed to hear, so I can get a sense of.
But
what,
then I'm
what
new.
You're
I'm very aware that I've missed, and I'm very sorry to the one that I missed yesterday. So
it's absolutely fine.
I'm happy sort of sitting and catching up, if that makes sense.
That's fine. Yeah. And I'm going to keep reviewing it anyway because I need to do that for everybody. So that's not just for you. So it doesn't matter. Yeah. I mean, the basic. What's the If we could say to Jan in one sentence the basic understanding that we spent all of yesterday explaining, what would it be?
Our thinking is our thoughts that create our feelings.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's
that's
the beginning and the end of it.
And it's not intellectual, it's
experiential.
Just
it's just a fact.
Mm.
And anyone who spends time enough to see that for themselves will realize that that's not a theory, that's just part of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way that we're wired. And that's not to say that we don't spend time in environments which are horrible. There's no contradiction there.
But what about our essential qualities that come? What about our feelings that are not generated by thought?
Such as?
Genuine senses of things, of journeys that we have to go on, things that we have to find, reading situations. I don't think it's always thought. I think it's probably a huge part of it.
Yeah, what would be the feelings that you said that are not coming from thought?
I think all emotions can be generated by thought and often are, but I think there are situations that people are instinctive. And if you.
Can you give an example? What would be one of these other feelings that's not coming from thought?
Understanding other people without necessarily a lot of information or communication.
Like an empathy you're talking about.
Empathy is a big thing. Senses of what is possible or what could happen or might happen without it being necessarily thought, like one feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Am I the only person that has this
situation? No, I'm sure you're not.
I'm not sure all my feelings. Sometimes my feeling comes first, and I know that what you're saying is that everything comes from thought because you're perceiving in a way, and it goes through your own filter and all those things. And I do accept that to a large degree, but I also think there's something more than that.
Mm.
I don't think we're purely thought feeling, not purely.
Mm.
I think I feel, and I think I've witnessed people feel things that are beyond thought.
I know it looks that way to me too.
We were talking yesterday about an innate sense of well-being that we all have, and then Ian drew this picture with the sort of the thoughts and the feelings of this sort of graph. So when somebody's in a really psychotic state, it's going to be like that possibly.
Yeah.
But you know, there is underneath this sense of well-being.
That's very helpful.
So
would that sense of well-being be more like soul? Deeper part.
Yeah, you could equate it to
okay.
that. Yeah.
Okay, that helps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The terms don't really matter.
So you're talking about the sort of creation of how we live as opposed to our true essence. Like the rubbish we put on top.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. But I would go a little bit further than that and to say that when I use the term thought, I'm not just talking about thought that I'm aware of or that you're aware of.
Okay. The
I'm using it in the broadest possible sense as being that thought. What I'm meaning by that term is the mental activity, or like the energy, if you like, that passes through our brain in moment by moment by moment, which actually creates our experience of life, and without which we wouldn't be having that experience.
Yeah, okay. That's helpful too.
And yesterday we used the analogy of a film projector, which we'll just go back to for a moment. So in that analogy, that metaphor, the projecting light we called consciousness. Yeah, the light of consciousness, which, as we said, is completely neutral. It doesn't matter what kind of film you put through it. It's just going to project that out, and it's going to give you that experience. So if I start having scary thoughts about rats or spiders or ghosts or something like that, it's going to say, okay, it's going to bring that to light for me. And then my physiology is always going to line up with what I'm thinking and feeling in that moment. So my body doesn't discriminate between so-called imaginary and the so-called real. And we all know that. If you've had a dream, and you know in the dream somebody's tapping on your window or about to break in or tiger's chasing you or something, if we were to monitor your physiology in that moment, your body responses would be exactly the same as if you were in that real life situation. Similarly, athletes who've been monitored in their training, what they found is that athletes can actually just visualize. They can be sitting in an armchair, visualizing themselves running that race or playing that stroke or whatever it is. When they do so, the physiology, they actually start to fire the same muscle groups as if they were really doing the activity. I mean, they actually found they can improve their performance by virtually as much as doing extra training without doing the training. There was a fantastic study done amongst basketball players where they found that was the case. They got the same increase in performance sitting in armchairs, just imagining themselves getting the shot over and over and over again. And they had another group who were actually doing the shots over and over and over again. They went up by about the same level without doing any activity, because it's firing the same muscle groups. So the body's learning the same. The body's doing the training because it doesn't know the difference between the imaginary and the real. Now, that's been puzzling to me for a long, long time. I've been intrigued by that whole phenomenon. It's like, why would that be, that the body doesn't distinguish between a dream tiger and an imaginary tiger, you know, and a real life tiger, or a rat that's just in my thinking and a rat that's actually running across the room? You'd think it would be to our benefit to know the difference, wouldn't you? That would make sense. And then it hit me why that's not the case. Huh? No, it's not. It's because it's intelligent. It's the opposite. I mean, that's how it looked to me for a long time. I thought, well, there's a kind of flaw in the system here. We should have the ability to discriminate and not get fooled by imaginary things to the extent that we're stressing ourselves out. But then I realized that when we experience something in the so-called real world, we experience it through the same filter of thought and feeling as anything that we're imagining. So of course we experience it in the same way.
Why is that intelligent?
Because it wouldn't make any sense to have two different ways of experiencing life.
But that's what we're all aiming for. That's what you're trying to do here.
No, it isn't.
Which is to understand how our system works so we don't artificially trigger. Because if I'm in a room with a tiger, I still need to respond. And if I'm not, I really would like not to. I'm trying to teach us, surely, how to discriminate self-created anxiety, anger, fear, whatever we're feeling,
no,
compared to the real thing.
That's not what I'm trying to do. What I'm pointing out is that it's all self-created, which is a different thing.
Okay, so we put the tiger in the room for real.
Sorry?
We still need to respond to some things. Do you actually think you get to a point where you...
Absolutely you do, but I'll tell you something. If you're in a situation that is, let's say, potentially life-threatening, there's still a variety of ways you can respond to that.
Yeah.
And the optimum way to respond generally is from a place of being level-headed, calm and clear.
Yeah.
And in that sense, the so-called survival instinct is highly overrated. You know, what we call the fight or flight mechanism. Because what's been found is that most people in such a situation, what they actually do is neither, they freeze.
Yeah.
They become paralyzed with fear. And what's paralyzing them is not the situation, it's their thoughts about it. So we imagine that we need a certain amount of fear, say, in order to respond appropriately, and we don't. It's not true. It's a myth. There was an interesting program I saw not so long ago where they interviewed survivors of the Twin Towers being blown up in New York. Anybody see that? And it was an American interview. It was about an hour-long show. And they had quite a large group of people who managed to get out of the building by one means or another. Now, if you just ask somebody randomly, how do you imagine you'd be feeling when you're in, you know, you're on the 16th floor, you realise the place is going up in smoke, the building's starting to collapse, your chances of getting out are actually very slim. You see people jumping out of the windows to certain death. You say, how do you imagine you'd be feeling? What would you say? Panicked? Yeah, panic. Or
I think what happens sometimes, which I've noticed in situations, is when that such a moment arises, you just react. You're not actually thinking.
Yeah. Well, there were actually three main groups that were identified in terms of different responses. The first group did exactly what Caroline predicted. They panicked. They froze. And but for someone else's intervention, they would have been dead. So there was quite a large number of people. Basically, they knew that they needed to get out and they couldn't. They just couldn't do anything. They lost the ability to move or think straight or do anything. So they were no help to themselves or anybody else. So that's the so-called survival instinct. It would have killed them if it hadn't been someone else who'd actually dragged them out. Because they were so afraid that they were paralyzed with fear. Many of them lost control of their bladder and their bowels because they were just completely terrified. There's a second group who did more what you're pointing to, Trishna, where they found that this extraordinary calmness came over them. And it's kind of, when they thought about it afterwards, it took them by surprise. They said, I've never been so calm in my life. I just knew exactly what to do. And they said, without thinking, this was a commonest term that they used when they described it. I didn't even think. I just grabbed hold of a person. I said, we need to go this way. You know? Without thinking. That was the key. So without the intervention of that thought, they had no fear. Absolutely no fear. And they were highly efficient. They knew exactly what was needed. So the only thinking they had was what was responsive to the situation, what was actually useful. There was a third group who had something similar, but they had an additional feeling of overwhelming love and compassion for the other people that they were seeing in this situation, which again took them by surprise. You wouldn't imagine that, would you? That's the feeling that was more dominant than anything else. They said they just looked at the fellow human beings in this horrible, horrible situation, and they felt like their heart was just bursting with love and compassion. And they were like, huh, you know, isn't that weird? In the midst of all this, that's what was coming. And somehow they were able to respond and help people.
Was that the default setting
Sorry?
Is that the default setting you mentioned? The
exactly.
Innate
exactly.
Intelligence is...
That's part of what we come in with.
You know.
Yeah.
We're
all compassionate beings.
Yeah.
Underneath everything else.
Mm-hmm.
We're all loving beings. We're all empathetic towards other people. And you see that even with young children. You know, my son, when he's less than 2 years old, if he hears another baby crying, he goes, huh? You know, he wants to make it okay. It's like he goes and puts his hand on him or something. Since it's built in, that, you know, I'll go with you in what you said, there is something that's built in. But these tends to be the attributes that come to the fore in these sort of circumstances, but we all have them. We all have the ability to think very clearly, to find solutions that we wouldn't necessarily recognise that there was one available. We all have the ability to do things that we wouldn't think ourselves capable of under other circumstances. But the crucial thing there is it's when the personal thought is not interfering with that. So when the personal thinking is not contaminating the intelligence, if you like, that we're all connected to, that's just what comes through. It just comes through clean. And it comes through as love, compassion, helpfulness, whatever it is that's needed. Whatever's responsive to the situation is what comes through.
And that's the connection to each other. Everything,
yeah.
That.
Yeah.
It does often, not always, of course, but it can be a life-threatening situation that allows that connection.
Exactly.
That happens so quickly.
That's often what interrupts. Yeah, that's what interrupts the person's thinking.
Yeah.
It's just that the situation is so extreme, they don't have time to get caught in their own thought process. Yeah, so it literally stops it in its tracks.
Did they, out of interest, did they talk about that continuing anyway?
Some did.
Yeah.
They felt like
it had
opened something for them which had stayed open. And they described it in very beautiful terms. Yeah. It was like a healing for them in some sense. You know, they saw people differently now. People that they'd been judgmental about, they really saw the humanity. And that was very nice. Yeah. So, again, when we talk about what is a stressful situation, well, that's about as stressful as it could get, isn't it? And yet it wasn't for many of them. Not only was it not experienced as stressful, it elevated them to a higher plane of consciousness. They experienced something that they'd never experienced before. Mm-hmm. As opposed to
being afraid of it.
Exactly. Yeah. And you see, anybody who says they're afraid of death, they're not. It's only their thinking about it that's frightening them. Anybody who actually goes through the death experience says it's the most beautiful thing they've ever experienced. You know, all the ones who did that and came back to tell the tale, which is tens of thousands, they all say it's the most beautiful thing. Every one of them, without exception, says that it's absolutely beautiful. They just feel overwhelming peace and at ease, and all cares and anxieties fall away immediately. Or if you know that for sure, what would you possibly be afraid of? It's ludicrous to be scared of that.
I mean, as a nurse, we don't talk about people dying.
Well, as a culture, we don't. If we can avoid it,
it's not an option, is it?
No.
Talk about everything but
exactly
accepting positive coach. It's like hospices, isn't it? They're just, I think they're the most peaceful places because they're accepting that that's going to happen.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
So it's very different. It's a different world.
You're right. And that, just that, is very healing.
Yes.
That's what creates a healing environment, is where there is that acceptance of something that everybody else is hoping and pretending is not going to happen.
Because it is really the only thing we are sure about, isn't it?
It's a great certainty. Well, there's another thing you can be sure about. All your feelings are coming from your thinking. You can be sure about that too.
Get back to a 9/11 example.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether there's a difference between that sort of, you know, very stressful situation, but you know it's kind of life or death and it's going to happen in the next 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And a stressful situation you're kind of sitting through every single day, whether it's at work or at home or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
There's a sort of grinding stress rather than a,
yes,
fight or flight kind of,
yeah,
here and now.
Yeah. I mean, the only difference really is that in those situations we fall into a habitual mode of thought, which becomes so familiar to us we think it's normal. And we attribute it to the, you know, this is just the deal because this is the situation I'm in, so I'm going to have to get used to it and knuckle down. And, you know, anyone in this situation would feel this way. But actually it's not true. It's still not true. You can find people and put them in a similar situation, they wouldn't feel that way. So it can't be the situation. There is no such thing as a stressful situation. There isn't. There isn't. And I would invite you to start checking that out against your own experience.
If you put that in it, I don't mean to be devil's advocate here at all, but if you put in a very extreme situation, like I have to work in sometimes, where a child's being raped or something like that, I know it's difficult to talk about, but there is situations that are manifestly more stressful than others, and our own personal experience, of course, I could be more stressful. I have weak points and strong points, so something that's very stressful for me might not be for you.
Mm-hmm.
But there are real situations. I mean, how do you include that? Where, that are just really awful.
Absolutely. There are situations that are painful.
That would be for most people in Venice. It's not like a personal response to something.
Well, definitely. There are situations that are painful. There are situations of, let's say, deprivation and abuse and poverty and so on and so on. I'm not saying they're pleasant. But I am saying you'll still find a massive spectrum of difference in how a person experiences it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And what I'm pointing to is that that difference is coming from within the individual's thought system. And in that sense, it's true of all of us in any situation. How we experience it is coming from our thinking relationship to it.
And how we're thinking has also come from what's happened to us. Like, well, these situations are forming for young people.
They can be, but 10 people exposed to the same abuse,
yes,
will not formulate the same thoughts about it subsequently. So again, you cannot say that those thoughts are a result of what happened. Because if they were, everybody should be thinking the same way subsequently, and they don't. Yeah, there are patterns and tendencies, and there's always a bunch of exceptions. Now, if there's even a single exception,
okay, there's not,
then there's a hole in the theory somewhere. You know, if the event or the situation was really causative, it should cause it for everyone.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't. Therefore, the theory doesn't hold up.
And you also said yesterday that in most cases, for others' reasons, that they only monitor the ones that turn out bad.
That tends to be the case.
Or predominantly the ones that have got over it and become successful.
We haven't really studied that as
no.
nearly as much. There's actually a lot of people who experienced horrific entry into life. You know, their initial years of life were really, really, really horrible compared to the average experience. And yet, somehow, their own resilience was such that they found a way not only through it, but they thrived in life in spite of that initial.
There is
some limited research,
yeah,
I know.
Yeah, that we come in with a certain amount of resilience, and it's so different for everybody. And then that gets people through. There are certain things with that.
I know there is,
yeah,
some, but what I'm saying is it's about this much compared to the pathological side, which would fill this entire room.
Yeah, because that's empirical. What we're coming with.
Well,
politics.
It's not.
Yeah.
It's also
no,
it's just
that's
as empirical.
Yeah. And that's the history
it's,
of it.
It's just we haven't been looking in that direction.
So the newspaper which has the good news and the bad news.
Yeah.
It's all that much better.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's the emphasis. Yeah. That's what we've been emphasizing.
Yeah.
So then our attention is with the bad rather than the good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what we look at is how to put right what's gone wrong. And we look, it becomes solution orientated, but it's after the event. What we're not looking at is how did the person who managed to come through with relatively healthy self-esteem and a good self-image, how did they do that?
Yeah.
And if it's possible for one, how? Maybe that's possible for these others, they just didn't realise it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe that's a transferable or teachable skill, you would say. And as soon as you look in that direction, you see, well, absolutely, that's available to everyone. Even the ones who think they're damaged goods. They're not really. They just look that way from a certain perspective. Everybody's got that resilience. It's not exceptional.
That's where the politics hits in. You know, in whose interest is it to, you know, undermine the strength of the people? You tell them you're an eternal victim and that, you know, your past is going to control your future and all the television drivel and films out there. It's incredible. It's such a like an onslaught of, well, how does a person decide, somehow they decide innately maybe, to say, well, that's not for me. I know I'm being manipulated for financial reasons or whatever. And then they get on and do something amazing.
Mm.
But that might not get reported or held up as a fantastic, well, what could be just a normal thing actually.
Mm.
So it's, I'm not a conspiracy theorist or anything.
Just because I'm a bit paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get me.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
It's just interesting, you know. I stopped watching, I don't have a TV and I don't read the newspapers, but I do listen to Radio 4. I'm thinking, you just said that about 7 o'clock, and now at 9 o'clock you're saying something else, you're lying, liars. So I hardly take on what they're saying.
Well, that's the thing, is that it's not what's been said, it's the degree to which you take it on.
Mm.
You know, if you go into any bar in Spain, I guarantee there's going to be a TV on in the corner. 24/7. It's going to be on, non-stop. And it's going to be playing football, and it's going to be showing the news, and it's going to be showing a fashion show, and just one thing after another. That's what our thinking's like. It's like the TV in the corner of the room. It's always on. Now, the only thing that really counts is, to what extent do we get caught by it? So one person will walk into that bar and they'll go, oh God, why have they got the bloody football on again? I hate football. Jesus, isn't there a bar I can go to where they're not showing football? Bloody football. You get really annoyed by your own thinking. Someone else will go in and say, oh great, they're showing the football. Fantastic, I love football. Isn't that cool? Can you turn it up a bit? You know? And the whole spectrum of responses is what determines your life experience. It's not the fact that you've got this background noise going. It's, to what extent do you take it seriously? Do you make it important? Everybody's got a background noise of their own thinking. So I'm not saying you have to be able to switch that off. I'm just saying, see it for what it is. It's like breathing. It's just what we do. We think. We're thinkers. But there's a whole bunch of thought that you've been just discounting all of your life. There's a lot of thoughts that you have regularly and you just don't take them that seriously. And then arbitrarily, there's certain thoughts that we think we have to take seriously. So when you hear a certain thing on the radio, you get really angry about it, you get really indignant, you get really upset and righteous. And after a while, you start to see how random that is. Well, how come you're upset about that? Why are you not upset about this? It's just as big a deal. It's bigger, actually. And you see how arbitrary it is. We've just arbitrarily attributed importance to certain kinds of thinking and not to others. Yeah, perhaps. And often it doesn't. We just make some kind of false association that we think is real. And then we make it real. But actually it doesn't. A lot of people get upset by things. They've had no personal experience of that. None whatsoever. A lot of people fight what they think is other people's causes on their behalf. And they think that they feel that they're compelled to be angry and upset by that. And they wonder why you're not. You should be as well. You know, they try and recruit you to the cause. Do you know what I'm talking about? And you'll see that. And you realise, it's like, why are they so bothered about that? It's not even an issue in their life. Why should it be one in mine?
Well, don't you think it happens more when you feel that it impinges on what you may have personally been allowed or not allowed to do?
Could be, yeah. That's one area. Yeah, but it's just one area. But there's a whole other bunch of thought that's got nothing to do with that, that you may or may not take seriously. I mean, when you start to see it through that lens, you see, we get upset about the craziest things. And then we ignore all these other things that actually could be really important. It's completely random. It really is. There's no rhyme or reason to it. I don't think you'll find a good answer to that. I think you'll probably drive yourself crazy if you really went into the why. You'll never find a fully satisfactory answer, because as far as I can tell, it's completely arbitrary. Every now and again you'll be able to associate, okay, the reason this bothers me because that, but 9 times out of 10 you won't even have such a connection to make. It's just something that, well, that's what your parents did, or that's what someone who was significant in your life, they felt strongly about that, so you believe that you must as well. It's totally random.
Is it sometimes when you're down on your purpose that you resonate with certain things because you're able or choose or hear to do something about it? It could be.
But then the idea that you have to get upset by it in order to do something, that's also nonsensical.
Well, there's a difference between being upset and caring.
Yeah.
Totally, totally weak. I presume it's harder to act.
Yeah.
But to be
Exactly. Yeah. I'm talking about being distressed by it, such a thing. Yeah. Whereas, of course, there are things that I'm interested in this, that person isn't. You know, that's an area of concern for me. It's not an area of concern for someone else. We've all got our predilections that way, for sure. But there's no reason for it to spoil your day, you know. Or your life. Let's have a little break. It's 11. It'll take about 20 minutes. 20 minutes break, something like that.